Rival Consoles with the tune Now Is. Before this, we heard Agoria with Kiero from the release Unshadow. Also Andrew Macari there with What I Want from Blind Energy. And near the beginning of that set, we had Chris Liebing with 10 West from the release Another Day. And that's about it for me for today. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. Feel free to check out my website at djfirefly.com.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear how the labor movement is preparing to protect workers under a hostile Trump administration. We'll speak with Professor Eric Blanc, author of We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. Professor Blanc offers hope for all workers who can use digital tools to organize and empower themselves.
We have another in our series of shows about fascism by talking to Diane Feeley, a labor historian and activist, about the consequences of unions in the U.S. continuing to place their workers' fate in the two major political parties.
Stay with us. I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The bank robber Willie Sutton was asked why he robbed banks. He famously replied, "Because that's where the money is." We're interested in the labor movement not only for humanitarian reasons, but because that's where the power is. Union members can withhold their labor and bring the economy to a standstill. Unionized workers gained ground in 2024. Union workers in the private sector saw a 6% rise in real wages last year. But overall, the working class has not had an increase in their real wages in 50 years. The cost of rent, groceries, health care, and other basic needs are becoming more and more out of reach, even for those working full-time jobs. As Donald Trump takes office on January 20th, many are preparing for a real threat to our standard of living and democratic rights. After all, his cabinet includes architects of the controversial Project 2025 initiative, the conservative blueprint that the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees calls, quote, a radical attack on working people and their unions. How will the battle for workers' rights unfold this year and beyond? To help us understand what's at stake, we're joined now by Eric Blanc. Professor Blanc teaches labor studies and employment relations at Rutgers University, and he's an organizer trainer in the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee. He's the author of Red State Revolt, The Teacher's Strike Wave and Working Class Politics, and his work has appeared in The Nation, The Guardian, and Jacobin, among other publications. His latest book is We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. Professor Eric Blanc, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on.
On December 18th, author Jenny Brown wrote in the monthly magazine Labor Notes, quote, strikes and organizing gained scores in 2024, but storm clouds loom. Remind us, what is Project 2025? And what does Trump and his team have in mind with respect to reducing the power of labor and lowering the standard of living for people in general?
What we know is that the Trump administration is going to be anti-union. The extent to which it's able and willing to implement the full Project 2025 agenda remains to be seen. Project 2025, as many listeners might already know, is a sort of right-wing think tank and project to radically transform the American government and political economy to benefit the rich and powerful. Whether Trump's able to do all of the proposals in Project 2025 remains to be seen. It might be counterproductive for the billionaire class and for the rich to attack all unions and all working people so drastically. My guess is that they're likely to proceed picking off one target after another if they can. But what we know is that the Trump administration will be viciously attacking working people, be attacking, obviously, immigrants and many of the most vulnerable, but also federal government unions, I think, will be under major attack. K-12 education unions will be under severe attack. And the reality is that the National Labor Relations Board, which governs labor law in this country, is going to be very unfavorable to unions. So the terrain is going to be harder for labor organizing. On the other hand, the attacks of the Trump administration themselves are likely to spur a lot of resistance and organizing to ward off the worst of Trump's attacks.
Well, let's talk about Amazon, one of the largest corporations in the world. It makes billions of dollars in profits, abuses its workers, and has resisted unionization. Last week, the Amazon Labor Union, which represents warehouse workers around the country, went on strike for 3 days. Please tell us about this and about the background of the Amazon Labor Union.
Yeah, listeners might remember that there was a historic unionization win in Staten Island in 2022. Chris Smalls and sort of a band of other workers with no resources essentially were able to surprise everybody, including the labor movement, and win a union election at one of the biggest warehouses in the country for Amazon. And so ever since then, the organizing at Amazon has really taken off. And what we're seeing now and what we saw in the strike in December is the movement has spread. And that's really good news, because for a while it seemed like maybe it would just be stuck in Staten Island. But it's spread in part because the Amazon Labor Union has affiliated with the Teamsters, which is, of course, a major national union, and they've been putting real resources towards organizing. So now there's, in addition to the Staten Island drive, there's been almost a dozen new drives have gone public amongst drivers, Amazon drivers in particular, all across the country. And so what you saw just a few weeks ago then was thousands of workers striking at Amazon all across the country to demand that the company start bargaining with them. Because unfortunately, in the U.S., labor law is such that even if you win a union election, even if you have a majority of workers at a given shop saying that they want a union, the company is only forced to bargain with you if you force them to. The law doesn't really oblige them to, so you have to strike, you have to raise the costs on employers so that they feel the necessity to come to the bargaining table. And so far, Amazon has refused.
And can you tell us a little more about what that connection, that affiliation with the Teamsters brings to the table? How do the workers align with them, and what are some of the other action items?
Well, the main reason I think that the workers felt it was important to affiliate with the Teamsters is that they just realized this is a huge corporation. This is a behemoth. This is the corporation that's transforming the world, transforming the United States. And in order to take on and essentially defeat such a huge corporation, you need some level of resources. And so having an independent union didn't seem viable for organizing on a national scale. So that is why the workers affiliated. And I think that was the right decision. Of course, it brings its own tensions because like any major institution, the Teamsters have their own sort of bureaucracies, and you know, there's always going to be tensions between a bottom-up effort and maybe some of the routines and orientations of existing unions. But by all accounts, this has been crucial. This partnership has been crucial for getting to the point now where there is a real national effort to organize Amazon. And so I think that's a very promising sign.
Well, sort of related to that, traditionally trade unions in the U.S. have taken the pragmatic position of rewarding their friends and punishing their enemies, which has meant typically supporting either the Republican or Democratic Party. But last year, Teamster President Sean O'Brien spoke at the Republican National Convention praising Donald Trump. But then the union refused to endorse any presidential candidate. What are your thoughts on this? What's going on?
Yeah, it's complicated. I think that the approach of Sean O'Brien in some ways is new. The approach for decades of labor has been to sort of uncritically back whatever Democrat is running. And O'Brien's approach in many ways is a throwback to the older pre-1930s, pre-New Deal approach that you described as, you know, rewarding your friend, punishing your enemies, in which the unions sort of go back and forth between the different politicians, different parties, and see what favors they can get and sort of do realpolitik that way. The problem is that both of these approaches ultimately is deferential to politicians. And so both approaches tend to be based off of a conception of politics, which is based off of who you know, who you talk with behind the scenes, and not on building the independent sort of power of working people. So the extent to which it reflects a break or a shift is actually in many ways limited. In some ways, it's more of the same. It's just now politicking with the Republicans and not just the Democrats. And neither is likely to go very far. The big contradiction here, of course, is that O'Brien, to his credit, wants to organize Amazon, is putting real resources towards organizing Amazon. Yet the Trump administration is deeply embedded now with the same billionaires that are actively trying to prevent unionization from spreading at Amazon. So Bezos is meeting with Trump, and Musk and company are suing to potentially overthrow the National Labor Relations Act. And so there's a contradiction here in the Teamster strategy. I think it's likely to, if the organizing continues, mean a break with the Trump administration rather than more cozying up, but we'll see.
Well, the Teamsters, like all unions, are represented by individuals and individual caucuses and locals. So please talk about the role of the left or progressive caucuses within the unions as a strategy for change, such as the Teamsters Democratic Union.
One of the exciting things about the last few years has been the growth of the fighting wing of the labor movement. And part of the reason that O'Brien got elected and the Teamsters, but particularly if you look at the United Auto Workers, this is where you see this project going advancing even further, is that caucuses and rank and file workers have pushed to transform their union. So in the Teamsters for Democratic Union, TDU, has been organizing for decades. And that led to O'Brien's election, and a lot of this organizing at Amazon comes out of that. And then in the auto workers, you have the election of Sean Fain, a real militant, who now is pushing to organize all auto workers across the South, led a very successful strike in the Big Three. And so you do see that when the rank and file and maybe more left-wing elements of the union movement fight to transform unions, it can have a really massive impact. And I take a lot of hope out of that because, unfortunately, most unions still are very stuck in inertia, very stuck in routine, and are not anywhere near meeting the scale of the crisis we're in. So it's going to be up to workers from below and left-wing activists within their unions to really push hard to transform these unions to meet the moment.
Well, that leads to another segue, which is, how many workers are there in the American labor force overall? And can you tell us how many are in unions, and even more specifically, how many are in public sector unions?
Yeah, so union density, which is the percentage of the overall workforce in unions, is 10% across the board. So for the entire U.S. economy, 10% of workers are in unions. In the private sector, that number is only 6%. So in the private sector, you only have 6% of workers in unions. And more unions these days, more union members these days are in public sector unions than in private sector unions. So, you know, the biggest union in the country is the National Education Association, which is of K-12 teachers. So we have really across the board very low numbers of union members as a whole, and particularly in the private sector. Unfortunately, the union movement hasn't really prioritized growth in a significant way and new organizing based on the assumption that unions would only be able to grow after labor law is passed. But the reality is that's not likely to happen anytime soon. And so unless there's a new, more ambitious organizing approach, it's unlikely we're going to see major union growth or labor law reform.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Maria Hall, and I'm speaking with Professor Eric Blanc about what's at stake for the labor movement as Trump is poised to take the White House. Well, Professor Blanc, according to the U.S. Treasury website, union membership peaked in the 1950s at 1/3 of the workforce. What happened?
A lot of things happened, but the big story really is that employers organized a major counteroffensive already starting in the 1940s against unions. So we saw the constriction of labor law. Some listeners might have heard of Taft-Hartley, which really restricted labor rights in the late 1940s. That put a stop to the forward momentum of unionization in the U.S. Things stayed steady for a few decades. So union members were strong in hard industry. But starting in the 1980s, you have a real dramatic nationwide counteroffensive unleashed by Reagan, but also supported by corporate Democrats and the Democratic Party as a whole, to decimate unions and then also to offshore the bastions of union strength like manufacturing, which you saw dramatically decline under Clinton and with the NAFTA free trade agreements in the 1990s. So what you see is essentially a political and economic counteroffensive against unions that goes back decades, but accelerates in the 1980s to get us to this extent today, where unions were left flat-footed in response to these attacks and are really only still starting now to try to figure out how to rebuild their strength when they can't rely on support from above.
So one reason workers have power is that they can withhold their labor and bring the capitalist economy to a standstill. But it's doubtful that it can be done through either the Republican or Democratic Party. Do you agree? And if so, do you support the creation of a third party, a labor party, based on unions?
I think it would be a tremendous step forward if a labor party or workers' party was formed in the United States. The obstacle here is not the desirability of that goal, but that the U.S. political regime, as it's currently set up, makes it incredibly difficult to do that. The lesser evil problem is a real one, that the spoiler issue that means that if you end up voting for a third party, you might end up helping the Republicans win, plus a host of other institutional obstacles, means that I think it's very unlikely you're going to see the creation of a labor party before a democratization of the U.S. political regime. I don't think there's space, even though I wish there was currently, to build a third party in a meaningful way. And so what that means, in my view, is that labor movements and the left have to build an independent political voice through things like primarying corporate Democrats, running independents, maybe on a local level, but essentially building an independent working class oriented wing inside and outside the Democratic Party. So the Bernie Sanders campaign, I think, showed the potential for this approach to really appeal to millions of workers. And by building up, I think, a working class voice within the broader anti-Trump camp, that's going to be the type of thing that can organize millions of people and get the ball rolling that could eventually lead towards some form of mass workers' party, whether it's by transforming the Democrats or breaking. It's very hard to anticipate. But I think that at this current moment, the main thing is building the union movement and building a sort of an anti-corporate political insurgency through primaries.
What's the status of the AFL-CIO? Can it be reformed? And if so, how? And if not, what's the alternative?
I think the orientation that is most effective is to transform and strengthen the existing unions and union institutions that we have, even if they're ossified and even if they aren't working in the way they should. It's just the most proven path towards building power. We've seen that even a union like the United Auto Workers, which was extremely corrupt and top down, was able to be seized and transformed and democratized from below. So I think that unions, even when they're bureaucratized, can be taken back by their members. And I would add that the AFL-CIO as such, which is the national coordinating body for different local and national unions, is actually quite weak. The major power source in the labor movement are national unions and particularly local unions. It's a very atomized movement, and that's part of the problem. So even if you were to transform and elect a firebrand leftist to the head of AFL-CIO, the real dilemma is how do you transform all of the local and national unions? Because that's really where the resources are, and that's where the organizing initiatives need to come from. That being said, it would be great to have an AFL-CIO that was setting more ambitious goals and that was playing a role like it did in the 1990s, that was trying to raise the ambitions of the labor movement. That's not currently what we have.
Professor Blanc, we know you have a new book coming out next month about the new labor upsurge. It's called We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. Can you give us a preview of some of the main themes that you're discussing in your book?
Yeah, thanks The book, in many ways, is telling the story of the recent unionization upsurge. I hope that will inspire listeners to organize their own workplaces and hopefully to not despair too much about the future of this country, because we have seen working people in very large numbers taking action to democratize their workplaces by organizing. So the book looks at this recent upsurge from Starbucks to Amazon to the auto industry to make sense of what the lessons are for going forward. And my argument is that this bottom-up workplace effervescence has developed a new organizing model that's capable of organizing not just thousands, but by millions of workers. And the reason it's able to do so is that it depends far less than traditional unionism on staff. So the types of responsibilities that historically staff have had to play in the union movement, whether it's training a new drive or strategizing or supporting and coaching workers to win, now is more and more being taken on by workers themselves. And so this is a new dynamic, and it means that unions with the same amount of resources can organize just far more workers, because now, for instance, at Starbucks, they won an election in 2021 in Buffalo, New York. One small shop won. They got all of a sudden so much interest across the country that baristas across the country were reaching out to them saying, how can we do the same? Well, they didn't have staff. They didn't have staff to talk to all of these hundreds and eventually thousands of shops. So they had workers themselves get on a Zoom call and coaching other workers across the country in how they went at their shop. And then this is essentially spread out like a movement. And we've seen that same dynamic, the same worker-to-worker dynamic spreading, not just at Starbucks, but we've seen it organizing at Amazon, we see it in the auto industry, in higher ed, in media. And so the argument then is that we have to lean in this type of direction, because unfortunately the traditional organizing model in which you need one staff organizer for every 100 workers you're trying to organize, that can be effective. At its best, it can be extremely effective in helping those workers win. But it's just, there's not enough money and there's not enough staff in the country to organize millions of workers this way. And that's part of the reason why the labor movement hasn't really been attempting ambitious organizing like it should. So the potential for this movement to spread is very high, in part because it relies on young radicalized workers, it relies on digital tools, and less on the kind of risk-averse union officialdoms and institutions that in the past have been such an obstacle towards mass-scale unionization. But the future of this movement is going to depend on eventually pushing and pulling these unions to put real resources towards scaling up these bottom-up efforts.
So, Professor Blanc, for those workers out there who are not in a union but think, maybe I want to join a union, what kind of information should they be seeking, or where can they go to move forward with unionizing even under a Trump administration?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's really important to underscore that even though organizing will in some ways be harder under Trump, this is still an extremely favorable moment for labor organizing because of the momentum that labor has, because there's a tight labor market, because there's so much disaffection with the status quo, and so many false promises that Trump has made around making people's lives better. Only the union movement really can bring that about. And only you know, listeners and working people organizing at work can bring that about. So the first thing I would say to anybody listening is if you're not in a union already, you can and should form a union at your own workplace. People oftentimes think unions are only for like mine workers or factory workers. Any workplace can have a union. And what that requires is essentially you and some of your coworkers getting the ball rolling by talking to other coworkers, and you can do that, and we can help you do that through the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee. EWOC, you can go to the website workerorganizing.org. It's literally a project for any worker in any part of the country. You just sign up on a quick form and we'll connect you with an experienced organizer who can help you take the steps necessary to start building a union network. So if you're not already in a union, you should do that. And especially if there's any young people out there who are angry at the state of affairs in the country and are trying to look at how to be most effective at transforming the world, beyond just organizing your own workplace, I would consider doing a tactic that was very important over the last few years and that was very important in particular in the 1930s, which is salting. This is essentially where you consciously get a job at a strategic company or workplace with the goal of unionizing it. So salts were very important in the Starbucks and Amazon campaigns. And for any of you who are out there, there are a lot of avenues to salt right now. And if you reach out to me, you can just go to my website or look me up online. I'm very accessible. I'd be very happy to connect you to unions that are looking for salts and that at this moment understand that it's going to be by fighting and fighting hard at the workplace that we're going to be best able to overcome Trumpism. So I don't think that the labor movement inevitably has to sort of go into hibernation for the next 4 years. I think it's actually going to be through ambitious organizing, through salting, through people organizing their own workplaces that we're going to turn the political tides against Trumpism.
Professor Blanc, I can tell you're very inspired by this moment to get out there and fight the battle. So what advice do you have for people who may be feeling underwhelmed or demoralized right now?
I think it's reasonable to feel that way. I certainly felt that way for a few days and a few weeks after the election. So that being said, the reality is that things have been really bad in this country for a really long time. And so it's not like just because Trump got elected that all of a sudden a perfect country has gone down the tubes. The question then is really, what is the potential we have for making change under this new regime? And I think the reality is it's still very high. Trump has made promises he can't keep. This sort of populist rhetoric talking about working people clashes every day with the reality of an administration that is first and foremost oriented to and being run for billionaires. So there's just a huge gap there between the promises and the reality. And that creates a big space, I think, for the left to fill. And just more generally, as far as the sense of despair that people have, the reality is we never know how things are going to play out. We don't know what is going to happen in a few months, what's going to happen in a few years. And that can be scary. But I take some solace in that because, to give one example, under the first Trump administration, we saw the first major strike wave in decades. That was the Red State Teachers Revolt in 2018. It happened in the most unlikely of places, where teachers in Arizona, West Virginia, Oklahoma, you know, organized by the hundreds of thousands and won under Republican regimes. So I think it's that type of confidence in working people and confidence that even if things are hard today, we need to have confidence that people are going to eventually fight back. That is how I sort of wake up in the morning and don't just fall to despair. And it's not always easy. And I think there's easier days and harder days. But I think ultimately working people do have the power to transform the world, whether it's under Trump or anybody else. And so we need to get involved in that and make that happen.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Eric Blanc. Can you remind us where we can follow you and your work and where we can find your book?
Yeah, the easiest way to follow my work is to sign up for my Substack, which is Labor Politics. So if you go to Labor Politics online, I think it's laborpolitics.com, you can find my Substack, and I publish there a lot. And then the book is also very easy to find. Just Google We Are the Union with my last name. It's by UC Press. And you can pre-order it now, and it'll be out mid-February.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Eric Blanc, Assistant Professor of Labor Studies and Employment Relations at Rutgers University and author of We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. Thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The forces of the gathering authoritarian storm in our country are evident in many ways. It is manifesting itself in powerful and continuing nationalism, in disdain for human rights, in the entwinement of government and religion, in a controlled mass media, in the protection of corporate power and the suppression of labor power, and in the encouragement of violence. The power of labor has been channeled into the Democratic and Republican parties, the twin parties of capitalism. We need a workers' party, but we don't even have the nucleus of one. Race and gender are formative in the building of authoritarian regimes. We see this in the USA. Haitians who are black have been accused of eating cats and dogs. Women's rights to control their own bodies is under attack from the Supreme Court on down, and women are marked as childless cat ladies and told to stay home and bear children. We speak today with Diane Feeley on race and gender as formative in building authoritarian regimes and the potential power of our labor movement long buried in the clutches of the Democratic and Republican parties. Diane Feeley is an editor of the magazine Against the Current. She's a leader of Solidarity, a socialist feminist organization. Diane lives in Detroit, where she's been an activist for many years in the United Automobile Workers Union. Diane Feeley, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks.
Diane, Chris Hedges, our previous guest, who inaugurated our series on fascism, what it is and how to fight it, is of the opinion that labor has to be central to protecting ourselves and to fight back. Why is this so?
Well, I agree with Chris on this. First of all, the membership of a union is diverse. And since we live in a highly segregated society in terms of where we live, the kinds of schools we go to, it's really the most diverse place we will be in. And we're there for quite a while every week. Not only is it a diverse place where people of all opinions, of various races and ethnicities and genders all work. And what is our job? What is the idea of a union? A union is not an insurance company. It's a membership organization. And therefore, it's about what we want in terms of our wages, our working conditions, our benefits. So we're concerned about the quality of our life, the security of our life, not only at our workplace, but also in our communities. So it's a very social place to be. And it's also a very democratic or potentially democratic place, where we have to listen to each other, where we get to debate and discuss and decide what our priorities are. So all of this really teaches us solidarity, not only with who are our co-workers, but other people, because we can't just be concerned about our own selves. We live in this larger world. So that sense of solidarity, that sense that we are all human, operates against the idea of fascism, where only some are humans and others are subhumans. So it's really a very important institution in our society to really develop ourselves as human beings. So the potential of democracy through the unions, of course, can have a big impact, not only on our jobs and our communities, but in a broader sense in our world and how we organize ourselves.
Diane, historically, the trade union movement in the United States has taken the pragmatic position of rewarding your friends and punishing your enemies. Sometimes they've supported the Democrats, therefore, and sometimes the Republicans. But what has been the result, do you think, of this pragmatism? I mean, after all, the wages of workers in America have not gone up in real terms for, what, 50 years? And now we see a growing fascist movement, which is enjoying historic support among many sections of the working class. So how do you assess the consequences of this traditional union pragmatism?
I think it shows how so much of what we've learned in school and in our society and even in some unions is actually wrong and not helpful to us. We are taught that, I remember in grammar school learning that if you didn't like the situation in your country, you voted out the party that was in power for the other party. That is, it was a two-party system. And also a great focus on the individual candidate rather than on the structure. What's the structure of our society and how can we make that structure better meet our needs? So in terms of the unions, I think a lot of the concessions were sold on the basis that they were absolutely necessary for our jobs. I mean, I retired as an auto worker, and I had the opportunity of debating this issue. Would it save our jobs if we accepted two-tier wages? And my argument and my organizing was, no, it did not, that in fact it would just bring more concessions. But this is what we're told, that the concessions are necessary because the auto, in this case it was the auto industry, is going through restructuring, outsourcing, or automation, and that we just had to bite the bullet until times became better. But of course they never became better because we accepted the concessions. And so we have to break out of this mold and seek a different way. And I think that's something that the UAW is trying to do now through our stand-up strike strategy that we used. So we have to develop a different perspective about how we fight for ourselves. And that includes, in my opinion, breaking with the two-party system, because it does not represent our needs, as you can see in the platform of both of the parties.
Diane Feely, what's going on in the Teamsters Union? It's one of the most powerful unions in the country. The president of the Teamsters Union, Sean O'Brien, addressed the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. He spoke admiringly of Trump, calling him a tough son of a bitch. He got wild applause. The union then took a neutral position in the upcoming election, but a majority of the members of his union say they support Trump, and Trump wants to get rid of unions. How do you explain all of this?
Well, first of all, I don't think a majority of the membership of the union does support Trump, although I think probably a good portion, maybe a third or even a little bit more, supports Trump, because they see him as an alternative to the neoliberal policies that have existed, that both Democrats and Republicans have carried out. It's really sad when some people who see this racist, hierarchical guy as some kind of an alternative, but I think that's really what they see. Many of them say, well, I may not agree with him on reproductive rights. I may not agree with him about this, that, or the other thing. But when he was in power, the economy was in better shape. As if the economy has very much to do with who's president of the United States in a capitalist society. So I think it just shows how badly educated we are. And I must say, there are sections of the Teamsters who have broken with the idea that Trump represents an alternative. I think the Black Caucus has a different position. I think there are other regional and local Teamsters who have different positions. Unfortunately, there really isn't the kind of alternative there should be, where there's another alternative to neoliberalism or the kind of neo-fascism that Trump represents on the ballot in all 50 states. Because, of course, the two-party system likes to perpetuate itself. And so that's the horrible situation that we're in.
You know, there's been a stirring of sorts, certainly in the labor movement. Currently, unionized workers in this country, including public sector workers, only about 11%. Whereas once upon a time, it was at least a third. But there's been a stirring in the movement. Amazon workers have voted to support a union. Railroad workers wanted to strike, but, well, they were prevented from doing so by the Democratic Party Biden administration. The teachers' unions in the last year, especially in West Virginia, Chicago, they've been militant. You believe that what we need is a workers' party. Currently, we barely have the nucleus of one. So, Diane, how do we get from where we are to where we have indeed a workers' party, and what might be the role of unions like those I just mentioned?
This is the big dilemma, because there are so many problems that prevent parties from emerging, whether we begin with the tremendous money that's involved and the kind of legislation that allows enormous amounts of money to prevent anything else. I see that the Green Party, even when it's been able to get all the petitions to get on the ballot, is being challenged by the Democratic Party, which just shows how undemocratic the Democratic Party is. So there are certainly all of these barriers that exist. Yet at the same time, it seems to me there's more of a sense that the two-party system is not in our interests. And therefore, kind of looking around, well, what can we do? How can we move ahead? And yet we see that the top leaders in the major unions are very wedded to the Democratic Party. So I actually think that we were set back 30 years ago when the under Tony Mazzocchi, there were attempts to start a labor party, and actually 11 unions signed on, but they were afraid to move to that next step of actually beginning to run candidates. So that was a setback for us. Well, how can we move forward now where there's a greater sense that we need a party that represents us? It seems to me we've got to begin small at the local level. I know in Detroit, many of the local offices are nonpartisan offices. So I think it would be a good idea if we began to run for those nonpartisan offices, get the experience, and begin to network so that we could do this. Now, actually, the Green Party, for example, I think has something like 150 people in office, all at very local levels. So it's possible that we could begin to do this and build a much stronger network, particularly based on a union here or a union there that would be willing to begin that process. So it's a difficult struggle. And I don't have a solution at the state or national level, but I think with developing that experience at the local level, that may give us the self-confidence to move ahead.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my longtime friend and colleague, Attorney Jim Lafferty, and we're speaking with Diane Feely. Diane, some years ago, the great economist and socialist leader Ernest Mandel observed that, and this is what he said, we're at the foot of the Himalayas without adequate tools, but we have to climb up. Would that be your assessment now?
I think so. I met Ernest Mandel a few times, and he would always ask me about the U.S. labor movement. And I would always say to him, well, we're down, but we're continuing to go down. So maybe at some point we'll be able to start moving up. So, yes, I think that we have a long way to go, but we have such a great need to begin moving that I think we just have to start.
Diane, please talk about how Trump is using both race and gender in building his support, and how historically fascism used race and gender as well.
Yes, this is a very interesting question to see how race and gender are the building blocks for fascism. And it's amazing to see Trump and Vance present a kind of masculist line. I tried to avoid the debates, but at one point I turned on actually the Canadian news hoping that they wouldn't be showing the debate. And what they had was a man on there tearing his shirt off. And it turned out this was a wrestler who was speaking at the Republican Party convention. I thought this was the perfect example of a masculinist symbol. And I think everything that they say and do reinforces that they are strong and therefore they can lead. So we have Vance who talks about the cat ladies. We have Trump and Vance talking about how Haitians eat cats and dogs. So what is this all about? It's all about dehumanizing people, their attack on trans people, All of this is to say there's two categories of people, the humans, which are us, and the subhumans. And who are the subhumans? Well, they're all the immigrants who, of course, are illegal under their definition. They're the women who really belong at home and in the house. They're the trans people. And they don't have equal rights. In fact, Vance even says it's only parents who should have extra votes. And presumably it's people who choose or are unable to have children who should have lesser rights. So this whole way of their conducting their campaign, I think, indicates the racial and gendered categories that they used. And this is something that is common, I think, to every fascist regime. If we look at the Italian government, and I think under Mussolini, it's different than under Hitler, but it's similar in terms of choosing which categories to see as human and which not to see as human. And interestingly enough, in all of these cases, the home is seen as this romantic place in which the woman is the, I guess, the queen of the home. She doesn't have any rights, but she's there as a sort of sacrificial figure. So all of this, I would say, in terms of Italy, it was the nation, the strength of the nation. In Germany, it was different. It was the strength of the master race, because even Germans who were disabled, had mental problems, were Jewish, were black, were not considered humans. So it's only the master race that can construct the nation. So all of this is pretty sick stuff. But I think it's really about the insecurity that people have in a society that is very insecure. And certainly we're facing an economic crisis now. And that was similar to the economic crisis that was happening after World War I. And certainly that had a big impact on both Germany and Italy, as well as other countries as well. And we're seeing that same kind of authoritarianism arise now as there is this economic crisis as we go into a late stage of capitalism. In fact, I call it geriatric capitalism because it's certainly at the end of its life, and yet there is no new birth that's coming into being, and that's what's creating this frustration.
Diane Feely, let's talk about Project 2025. How do you see this as helping the forces of fascism in the USA?
Well, to me, it's like it's their wish list. They have a wish list. They put forward all the things that they would like to do, not that they would be capable of doing them. And of course, I ask, well, where is our wish list? Because our wish list would be quite different from theirs. So if we look at some of the elements, we say, okay, they want to, quote, restore the family. That doesn't mean providing parental care, reducing work hours, developing a free public education that's of quality. No, it's stopping sexual orientation. It's saying that all federal laws and regulations should be stripped of any discussion of sexual orientation, gender equality, reproductive rights, saying, okay, for the Department of Health and Human Services, there should be a definition of marriage and the family, which should be biblically based. Biblically based. Well, that's quite a narrow view. That federal agencies should be stripped of their regulatory capacity, and that all of this should be basically placed under the office of the presidency. So without all of the regulatory agencies and the regulatory power, What do we have left? We've lost, I don't know, 75 years of regulations that are very important, whether we're talking about health and safety laws, whether we're talking about minimum wages. It's all gone. Whether we talk about the environment, it's very interesting that Trump and Vance speak a lot about the fears. They appeal to the fears of insecurity that people have. But that's usually related to the border or crime, even though crime is going down. But it's never related to the climate, which is our most severe problem. How can we live in the world without destroying our environment? Those are the things that we need regulations for, and yet that's something that's not at all considered. Now, if we take a look at what their plan, what Project 2025 plan is for the unions, they'd like to strip the unions of basically any power that we have, so that the National Labor Relations Board, which is one of the few agencies that's set up to be of help to unions, that can help organize elections to find out whether the workers at a place want a union, that would be minimized. I think Trump has said on the first day he was in office, he would fire the main person in charge, the general counsel of the NLRB, because she's too progressive. It would eliminate many of the rules that currently exist. And what it would do, and I think this is really important, is it would allow the employer to set up basically its own phony unions. And so this really takes us back really 100 years in terms of the kinds of labor legislation that we've had. Now, I think most people haven't taken a look at Project 2025. After all, it's a huge project. And as I say, it's a wish list. So even if Trump and Vance were elected, it doesn't mean it would come into being. It would be certainly, it would seem to me, that there would be many, many demonstrations and meetings and challenges, legal and on the street, to oppose that kind of wish list. But it just shows what their plan is for us and how we have to develop an alternative that's based on securing people's rights and living in a society that is a communal society and not one where everybody feels like they're in line and they better beat the other person because there's only going to be so much food or housing or jobs to go around. No, that's not that can't be our vision. Our vision must be one of solidarity, not just for our own family, but for the larger community and the larger environment in which we live.
Diane Feeley, we are sadly just about out of time, but tell us about the organization, one of them to which you belong, Solidarity, and about the publication Against the Current, which you help edit.
Thank you very much for mentioning that. So people can go to the website Against the Current and see our current and back issues and get a subscription if they'd like. They can go to this Solidarity-US website and look at the articles and ideas there. And we're actually running a series of classes on fascism, taking a look at history and today. And people can register for that. So thanks very much for having me on.
Thank you so much for joining us today, really, Diane Feeley. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane. It's been terrific talking to you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law & Disorder, we discuss a recent taxpayer class action brought against two California congressmen alleging complicity in genocide.
The lawsuit accuses these representatives of illegally misusing their authority to approve $26 billion in military aid to Israel.
We'll also speak with Professor Marjorie Feld about her book, The Threshold of Dissent, A History of American Jewish Critics of Zionism.
We will explore with Professor Feld how the suppression of dissent on college campuses today has historic precedent in earlier efforts to silence opposition to Israel's militaristic theocracy.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
On December 19th, 2024, a coalition of human rights activists and organizations filed an important class action lawsuit against California Congress members Mike Thompson and Jared Huffman. The lawsuit alleges that the representatives illegally misused their authority by approving $26.38 billion in military aid to Israel, despite evidence that these funds contribute to ongoing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. Supported by over 500 plaintiffs across Northern California, the case highlights growing public demands for accountability in U.S. foreign policy. It was filed by the group Taxpayers Against Genocide. At the core of the lawsuit is the argument that Representatives Thompson and Huffman ignored clear evidence of war crimes committed with U.S.-provided weapons, effectively forcing their constituents into moral complicity. Plaintiffs describe the profound emotional and moral injuries they've suffered resulting from their representatives' actions, emphasizing the legal and ethical responsibilities of these elected officials to prevent taxpayer dollars from funding human rights violations. The lawsuit seeks declaratory and injunctive relief, aiming to halt military aid to Israel and to secure accountability for decisions made in Congress, with plaintiffs ranging from seasoned activists to ordinary constituents. The case represents a significant legal challenge to U.S. military support for Israel amid increasing scrutiny over its devastating consequences for Palestinian civilians. Joining us to discuss this class action is Seth Donnelly, a Sonoma County resident, former Bay Area high school teacher, human rights advocate, and one of the founders of Taxpayers Against Genocide. We're also joined by Maria Barakat, a Lebanese-Palestinian anti-war activist, sociologist of law and society, and public policy expert specializing in equity from UC Berkeley. Both Seth and Maria are plaintiffs in the lawsuit. Seth Donnelly, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having us on, Heidi.
Seth, you're both a plaintiff in this lawsuit and also a key organizer. What are the central legal arguments on which the lawsuit against Representatives Mike Thompson and Jared Huffman is based?
Yeah, so the lawsuit, it's a massive class action that encompasses 10 counties, pretty much all in Northern California, and it brought together, you know, activists across these county lines. We have now over 700 members of the class, and then people like myself and Maria, who's also on the call, who are class reps from each county. Our fundamental legal argument is that even though Congress has wide latitude with its tax and spend authority, that latitude is not absolute. So Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution establishes that the tax and spend authority should be within what they call the interests of the general welfare and common defense. And that beyond that, even though, again, the courts have in subsequent cases given Congress wide latitude, they've also ruled that it's not an absolute latitude. We can find, for example, in 1968, the Supreme Court case Flass versus Cohen, where taxpayers sued over federal income tax dollars being used on private religious schooling purposes. And the court affirmed their standing to sue and actually, I believe, ruled in their favor in that case. What we are arguing is that just as Congress cannot appropriate and use our tax dollars to build private religious schools, they like...
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We searched approximately 364 properties in the Altadena area, and unfortunately during that search, we did locate three deceased. As these searches continue, I unfortunately anticipate that those numbers will increase.
Devastating wildfires in Los Angeles have killed at least 24 people, with dozens more missing. As the region braces for more dangerous winds, we'll talk about the historically black Altadena community, where Octavia Butler, the writer, is buried. It's been ravaged by the fires. We'll speak to Los Angeles journalist Sonali Kohatkar, who had to evacuate her home, and California climate researcher Leah Stokes. Then to Gaza, where Palestinian journalists are criticizing the lack of support from international media organizations.
We are just documenting a genocide against us. It's enough after almost a year and a half. We want you to stand foot by foot with us, because we are like any other journalists, reporters, and media workers all across the globe, no matter the origin, the color, or the race. Journalism is not a crime. We are not a target.
We'll speak with Palestinian reporter Abu Bakr Abed in Gaza. Then, as Poland reverses course and says it will not arrest Prime Minister Netanyahu under the ICC warrant if he attends the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz this month, we'll go to Brussels to the Hind Rajab Foundation. It's leading the effort to hold individual Israeli soldiers accountable for war crimes and making it very difficult for IDF soldiers who fought in Gaza to travel outside Israel. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll from the fires in Los Angeles has risen to 24, with dozens of people still missing. More than 12,000 homes and other structures have been destroyed or damaged as firefighters continue to battle the Eaton, Palisades, and Hearst fires. Los Angeles County Fire Chief Anthony Marone says the risk of new fires remains high.
Elevated critical fire weather conditions will continue through Wednesday. Please rest assured that your County of Los Angeles Fire Department will be prepared. These winds, combined with low humidities and low fuel moistures, will keep the fire threat in all of Los Angeles County very high.
The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and Los Angeles County have both declared public health emergencies due to the smoke and particulate matter from the ongoing wildfires. Meanwhile, the Mexican president, Claudia Sheinbaum, has sent a team of Mexican firefighters to Los Angeles. Laura Vasquez Azua is the head of Mexico's civil protection.
We will stay as long as necessary. We will support in a spirit of solidarity and with all our experience and commitment to the people of California.
As of Friday, nearly 1,000 incarcerated firefighters have also been deployed to help fight the LA fires. According to state officials, the incarcerated firefighters are paid a daily rate of between $5